Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We are less than a month away from the opening of the World Cup, which this year is being held in Brazil, where, as you may know, soccer is a national religion. All of the major regions of Brazil will be hosting games, and for us, part of the draw is getting to check out the music from places like Salvador and São Paulo and, of course, Rio de Janeiro, places we'd all love to visit. But there will also be a few games in the sweltering heat of the Amazon in the city of Manaus, which apparently no one wants to visit. The USA team has a game there, and head coach Jurgen Klinsmann is not well pleased. Still, the north of Brazil has some attractions for us music fans, and today we'll give you the first of our Soundcheck guides to Brazilian music with a look at Amazonian pop. It's not what you'd expect. And from the north of Brazil to a small town in the north of Iceland, we'll hear live performances of songs from Ásgeir and his record-breaking debut album. Speaking of breaking records, my first guest would like nothing more than to break every copy of this record.
The joy of creating. Force yourself to smile, and you'll soon stop frowning.
Here is the late great soul singer Isaac Hayes, like you've never heard him before.
Wax enthusiastic, and you'll very soon feel so. A being causes his own feelings. The greatest joy there is in life is creating. Splurge on it.
This poem he's intoning was composed by L. Ron Hubbard, the science fiction writer and founder of the highly controversial Church of Scientology. Turns out Hubbard employed a fair amount of music in his fiction and his religious beliefs late in life. Nathan Rabin recently wrote a piece for the online magazine Slate exploring L. Ron Hubbard's musical output. It's called L. Rock Hubbard, Revisiting the Curious Career of the Ultimate Cult Musician. You can find a link to it at soundcheck.org, and Nathan Skypes in from Chicago. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So explain briefly who L. Ron Hubbard is and why you were interested in his music.
Well, L. Ron Hubbard is one of the most fascinating people in the history of the world. I think I can say it without danger of hyperbole. And he was a very, very prolific science fiction author. Scientologists would tell you that he's one of the best and most popular science fiction writers of all time, / writers of all time. Other people are less charitably inclined. Mm-hmm. And he basically established this religion called Scientology that has a very interesting ideology. It's very, very controversial. He himself was extraordinarily controversial, especially towards the end of his life. I mean, the 80s, L. Ron Hubbard had basically gone into seclusion. People had no idea where he was. He hadn't made any public appearances in a very, very long time. So people naturally assumed that he was dead or he was being held captive or abducted for some reason. So, and to the point where his son sort of filed a motion to kind of get himself appointed the guardian of his father's estate. So, you know, so that he could control it. And he sent out this affidavit saying, not only am I not dead, but I have secluded myself like Walden. And I have this crazy, crazy outpouring of creativity coming up, one of which was this album called Space Jazz, which would be the soundtrack to Battlefield Earth. And again, it's very interesting to kind of look at the historical context for this. Mm-hmm. So this was 1982. So what were the big things in popular culture? It was Star Wars. It was Star Trek. It was E.T. And Scientologists are like, we not only have a man who has unlocked the secrets of the human mind, we not only have the wisest man in the world, we also have the world's greatest science fiction writer. It would be like as if Jesus Christ had also created Star Wars. And L. Ron Hubbard was a big thinker. He had big ideas. So his idea was, I'll put out this book, Battlefield Earth. It will be the greatest science fiction novel ever written. And for the record, it is Mitt Romney's favorite book of all time. Mm-hmm. for what that is worth. And then there would be this soundtrack album, which had never been done before, where somebody made a soundtrack not to a movie or a Broadway show, but to a book. And it had never been done before because it makes no sense.
Well, let's hear a little bit, you know, having been warned that what we're about to hear might not be the ultimate in, in musical experiences. But Space Jazz from L. Ron Hubbard, let's face it, he had a lot of great musicians there in the Church of Scientology, still does. Chick Corea, right. the keyboard player, the bass player Stanley Clark among them. And you hear both of them in this clip. The song is called Earth, My Beautiful Home. So that's Earth, My Beautiful Home, Space Jazz, 1982 album by L. Ron Hubbard, the sci-fi writer and founder of the Church of Scientology, keyboardist Chick Corea, bass player Stanley Clark, both performing on this record. But the album is credited to L. Ron Hubbard, right?
Right, right, right. And all of the four albums that I kind of wrote about for the piece, he's credited not only with providing the lyrics, but for writing the music as well, which is kind of a strange combination there. And you couldn't see me, but I was snapping my fingers in approval to some of that swinging space jazz, man. And that is about as good as it gets. And that is one of the kind of interesting paradoxes that I was exploring in this piece, is how can so many brilliant artists be Scientologists, yet Scientology art be so unbelievably terrible? And I think it's worth noting that, you know, these albums were not created by, say, Beck. You know, Beck is a Scientologist.
Right.
And if Beck were to make an album based on his faith, A, people, I think, would see it as some sort of elaborate postmodern joke. I think if some of L. Ron's lyrics were credited to Beck, they'd be like, oh, man, what a brilliant subversive postmodern deconstruction of, you know, mythologies. And not the ravings of a madman, but oh my God, what an interesting aberration. And when people say, you know, like, boy, that is one of the weirdest, worst albums of all time, that is true.
We're speaking with Nathan Rabin, who writes for TheDissolve.com, about his recent piece for Slate.com called L. Rock Hubbard, Revisiting the Curious Career of the Ultimate Cult Musician. You can find a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. Chick Corea is, you know, we heard him playing the piano a moment ago, but also on this record, he plays the Fairlight CMI, which stands for Computer Music Instrument. I remember, you know, this instrument gained quite a lot of currency in the early 80s because it was basically a kind of sampling keyboard. You know, you put any sound into it and then play it back anywhere on the keyboard. Why was that instrument so important to the ethos of L. Ron Hubbard's musical world?
Well, I think, you know, L. Ron Hubbard was, there are two parts to L. Ron Hubbard's personality and to his persona, one of which was the greatest science fiction writer of all time, and the other of which is the messiah of humanity. You know, they kind of built into one another. And the science fiction writer, you know, was very concerned with how can I create music that is the equivalent to these books that I've written? And I think the answer was to create, you know, science fiction-y instruments, things that sounded futuristic, things that sounded like what tomorrow might be, things that sounded like you might see in Star Trek. And that's one of the kind of neat things of kind of going back and looking at these albums, is they wanted to sound like the distant future and they sound like the distant past. Ron Hubbard never really got to make movies. So this was kind of his attempt to, like, I will make a movie just using sounds and instruments and words and do so in a way that is completely incoherent, that only Scientologists can really appreciate.
Let's go back to that 1982 record, Space Jazz, and hear this.
Oh, must we?
Yes, this instrument of the future, the Fairlight CMI, which now does have a kind of a dated early 80s sound, on a song called Wind Splitter. What the hell was that?
Full saloon in Andromeda 7. And again, I think that's, you know, sort of Elrond's opportunity to, like, work in all these different genres.
With the kind of fake horse neighing and fake galloping horse sounds.
Yeah, your saloon piano. It's all there, man.
Nathan Rabin Skyping in from Chicago. You have to read the article, L. Rock Hubbard Revisiting the Curious Career of the Ultimate Cult Musician. The link's on our website, soundcheck.org. I have to ask you, what kind of reaction have you gotten to this?
Well, the reaction that I got from my wife was...
That's not what I'm interested in. Have you heard from the Scientology department?
I have not heard from the Scientology community, but on Friday, somebody hurled a rock through my bedroom window, which is something...
Seriously?
Yeah, which is something that has never happened to me before, and I'm not quite paranoid to imagine that it had something to do with writing an article about Scientology. But it is something that has happened before in the past, where Scientologists have not looked favorably upon people who have written about them in a less than reverent fashion.
Which this article certainly is not reverent. The album Mission Earth is an L. Ron Hubbard project that you say actually rises to the level of mediocrity because it is performed by Edgar Winter, the classic rock guitarist from the 70s.
He does, and it's a really, really bizarre project where it is an adaptation. Again, it's an adaptation of one of L. Ron Hubbard's novels, although I guess in this case it is a 10-novel set, a decalogue. And one of the things that's kind of crazy about Mission Earth, the book, is apparently within it, I have not read it, it's like 5,000 pages long, like all of L. Ron Hubbard's stuff. Apparently it presents rock and roll music, like homosexuality, like a lot of other things, as being kind of this like very negative, destructive cultural force that people have to be on guard against. So the fact that it was then turned into a rock opera, I think is pretty, pretty fascinating. And it's not a great album by any stretch of the imagination, but it is so committed. And Edgar Winter just throws himself into it with this kind of lunatic abandon. In the piece, I kind of compare his commitment to that of John Travolta in the movie Battlefield Earth, which is just a terrible, terrible movie and a terrible performance, but so much fun and so ridiculous and so over the top. And that's kind of how I felt about Mission Earth as well. It's the only time in like the four albums that I listened to that L. Ron Hubbard's music, A, sounded like actual music, and B, sounded like it was being done by professionals and not a bunch of lunatics.
Well, this is from 1986's Mission Earth, Edgar Winter doing L. Ron Hubbard's Just a Kid.
Yeah.
Edgar Winter and Company doing Just a Kid from the L. Ron Hubbard album Mission Earth, 1986, one of four L. Ron Hubbard-themed records that Nathan Rabin writes about in his piece for Slate.com. Nathan's with me via Skype on Soundcheck today. You mentioned John Travolta. He actually appears on a later, there are a couple of other more explicitly kind of dogmatic Scientological records, right? That L. Ron Hubbard
made. Right. I mean, they're basically the two albums that we've talked about are basically science fiction albums, and you know, pretty poor examples of the form. And then the other two albums that I kind of wrote about are the Scientology equivalent of gospel albums, where these are albums and music and songs to espouse his ideas, to kind of convert the.
Dog?
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, he gets upset when I say negative things about John Travolta. So basically, the other two albums were basically created to proselytize, to spread L. Ron Hubbard's music and ideas to other people and to convert them into the faith. And Scientologists in 1986 were encouraged to buy lots and lots of these albums. They were encouraged to buy them in bulk and then to give them to their friends. And the idea is that they would be so in love with these songs and these music and their ideas that they would want to know more about Scientology. And the first song on the album combines three of the hottest talents of Scientology in 1986. John Travolta at probably the low ebb in his life and his career. Frank Stallone, everybody's second favorite Stallone brother, and Leif Garrett, who was a Scientology for about 3.5 minutes in between bottoming out. And this album that was released, I think, after L. Ron Hubbard died is unbelievably fascinating. And the lyrics on it, you really do believe that they're written by L. Ron Hubbard because they do not sound like music at all. Mm. And if they were created by ghostwriters, they were created by professionals, they would sound a lot more like sanity and a lot less like the ravings of a madman.
Well, now, you know, here's the thing, Nathan. I mean, we're talking a lot about, you know, L. Ron Hubbard writing this weird music, weird text, poetry,
right,
whatever.
Right.
But it's other people that we're hearing performing. Don't you have any moment here where we can actually hear the man himself?
On the album of the L. Ron Hubbard and Friends album, there's this huge, like, incredibly flattering, almost glamour shot picture of L. Ron Hubbard on the back. And for Scientologists, that would be almost worth the price of admission themselves, because here was this man who had gone into seclusion years and years ago, this mythic figure, and then here is a picture of him, and then the album actually ends with the voice of L. Ron Hubbard himself. And it's really, really fascinating because it sounds so processed and it sounds so synthesized that it sounds unearthly. It sounds like, not only does it not sound like L. Ron Hubbard, this does not sound like a human being. It sounds like something that was created by a robot. And again, the lyrics that L. Ron Hubbard sings at the end of this album, they're so, I think they're supposed to be humble or spiritual, and they come off as just unbelievably arrogant and smug. And yeah, if you could play it.
Yeah, I think we'll leave our listeners in the capable hands of L. Ron Hubbard himself.
Yes.
The Road to Freedom is the name of the record. L'Envoy, thank you for listening. The final track featuring the voice of L. Ron Hubbard. And we've been hearing the voice of Nathan Rabin, who wrote this piece for Slate.com called L. Rock Hubbard, Revisiting the Curious Career of the Ultimate Cult Musician. It's on our website, the link at soundcheck.org. Nathan, great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you as well.
I write just for you, but others hearing this may find things they would argue. I do not sing what I believe, I only give them fact. If they believe quite otherwise, it still will have impact.
Coming up, Björk and Sigur Rós are big names in Iceland, but right now they've got nothing on Ásgeir. The airy folk singer's album was a smash hit when the Icelandic version was released in 2012. Now it's getting still more exposure, with a new English language version. Ausgeer plays live in our studio next. And speaking of live music,
I don't think back, I don't need to.
Join Soundcheck as we bring two great bands to the stage at BAM on June 7th. It's WNYC's Radio Love Fest at the BAM Harvey Theater, featuring Hamilton Lighthouser of the Walkmen and Brooklyn's own San Fermin. Go to bam.org/radiolovefest for tickets.
I rest inside the hope of thoughts to come.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Here in our studio, we've been visited by quite a few Icelandic musicians over the years, including Jónsi from the band Sigur Rós, the group of Monsters and Men, the composer Ólafur Arnalds, a few others. They've all been great. But the Icelandic musician in our studio today has a debut album that is really unusual. It's called In the Silence, and it comes from the singer and multi-instrumentalist Ásgeir Einarsson, who records under his first name. We'll talk with Ásgeir in a moment about releasing his record in a different language, about lyrics written by his poet father, and about being a former javelin thrower. But first, let's hear him in the studio. Backed by the guitarist and lyricist Julius Robertson, here is Ásgeir with a song called Going Home, live on Soundcheck.
No, I'm going home. my mind is light. You're with me in the dark. Light my way at night. Let your light shine out. This burden weighs me down. The heaviest of weights knocks me to the ground. This burden weighs me down. Burden weighs me down. Burden weighs me down. Burden weighs me down.
That is the Icelandic singer and songwriter Ásgeir live on soundcheck, live at our piano, actually, in a song called Going Home, with Julius Robertson accompanying on guitar and backing vocals. Going Home is one of the songs on Ásgeir's new album called In the Silence. At least, it's new to us, although it's an anglicized version of a record that Ásgeir had released previously in his native Iceland. First of all, Ásgeir, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So the songs are all in English, but they were originally in Icelandic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you first sat down to start writing the songs, you did want to write in English originally, right?
Yeah, originally some of the songs were in English, but then we decided to try to do one Icelandic lyric to one of the songs, and it just sounded really good, so we kept on doing it, yeah.
And the Icelandic lyrics ended up coming mostly from your father.
Yes, that's
who,
right.
Now, is he known as a poet in Iceland?
Maybe just for the past maybe 5 years or something, because my brother has a band there also, back in Iceland, a reggae band.
An Icelandic reggae band.
Yeah. And my dad has been writing some of the lyrics for their band, they're really successful. So people know about my dad through that.
And Julius wrote 3.5 of the lyrics on the record as
yes,
well.
That's right.
And then to bring it back to English, you worked with John Grant, who's been here on Soundcheck, and a very gifted singer and songwriter, American, but he lives there, right?
Reykjavik. He lives in Iceland now. For the past 3 years or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how different are these songs in English as opposed to the original Icelandic?
Well, it felt really weird, you know, the first few weeks or months. We started with this translation late 2012, so it's been a long time, you know, and we've been touring ever since and been singing both Icelandic and English lyrics. And mixing it up. So I've gotten used to it now, but it was really strange in the beginning. Yeah.
We're speaking with Ásgeir, the Icelandic singer and songwriter and multi-instrumentalist. Now, you were saying that music for you, you've been doing it all along as kind of a hobby. When did you get serious enough to actually make a record?
Well, we started recording early 2012. I wasn't planning on making a record. I was just thinking about going to a real studio for the first time and recording one of my songs, maybe just to see how it would sound, you know. Mm-hmm. So I contacted this producer that worked on the album with me, and he's well known in Iceland and like one of the biggest So I was quite nervous calling him, you know, at the time. But yeah, he invited me to his studio and we tried one song and we just really clicked and kept on, you know, recording more songs. And in the end, after 3 months or something, we had this album, you know. And
and then it's triple platinum in Iceland. It's the biggest selling debut album in Icelandic music history. Did that take you by surprise?
Yeah, definitely. I thought, you know, maybe 300 copies would be sold, you know, or something, for just for the people in my hometown or something, you know, and my family or something. But yeah, this is, I never expected anything like this, you know.
Yeah. So, big surprise. The album is called In the Silence, and Ásgeir is with us here in the studio with Julius Robertson accompanying on guitar and voice. I think my favorite song on the record is Torrent. Is that the one you're going to do for us next?
Yes, that is right.
All right. So Ásgeir making his way back to our piano here in the Soundcheck studio. He is performing here in New York on June 19th. The concert is sold out at the Mercury Lounge. He's performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Torrent is the song. In the Silence is the record. Here's another live performance from the Icelandic singer and songwriter Ásgeir.
Rain.
Once again, the Icelandic singer Ásgeir and a song called Torrent, live at Our Piano with backing vocals from Julius Robertson. The album is called In the Silence, and the version of Torrent on the record, kind of a big production with electric guitars and drums, etc., but a stripped-down acoustic version for us here in the Soundcheck studio. And Ásgeir, you were saying before that, you know, music was at one point in your life a hobby. Now it's obviously much more than that. Have you had to give up the competitive javelin throwing that you used to do?
No, well, that was for other reasons. You know, it was when I was about 17 or 18 that I got injured and I had to stop throwing. But, you know, maybe I focused more on music then, so...
All right, well, you had something good to fall back on, at least. Does everybody in Iceland play music?
No. But most people.
I love that you had to think about that first.
But most
people
do.
I know one or two who don't.
Well, it's like that. You know, old kids go to music school when they're about 6 or 7, and then some of them drop out maybe, you know, at 9 or 10, but a lot of people keep on going, so... So, yeah, most people can play some instrument.
There's plenty of evidence of that on disc these days, and the latest addition to a growing repertoire of Icelandic music is the album In the Silence by my guest Ásgeir. He's playing a sold-out show here in New York on June 19th at Mercury Lounge. I'm sure we'll be hearing and seeing more from him in these parts again. Ásgeir, great to have you and Julius performing for us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I lift my mind to the sky.
Next, we go from chilly Iceland to sunny Brazil as we begin an occasional look at the music of this year's World Cup host country, starting with the Soundcheck Guide to Amazonian Pop. That's coming up next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. With the World Cup on the horizon, all things Brazilian will be getting a lot of attention, and we here at Soundcheck will do our best to bring you the sounds of Latin America's largest country and host of this year's World Cup. Brazil really is a musical world unto itself, and today we'll start by presenting the Soundcheck Guide to Amazonian Pop. We're going to take a tour of a somewhat remote part of the country that has become a hotbed of musical innovation. And my guest is Marlon Bishop, a frequent Soundcheck contributor and producer for NPR's Latino USA. Marlon has just edited a book about Brazilian music, which includes his own essay, Welcome to the Jungle, The Rise of the Amazonian Sound. Marlon, welcome back.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
So we are not talking about traditional Amazonian, you know, the Xingu and the other native peoples and flute music and stuff like that. We're talking about a form of pop music, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, any kind of thought you might have about the Amazon, if you were to approach Belém, would go out the window because...
Belém is the big city in the state of Pará. So we're way up north in Brazil.
Exactly. This is the far north of Brazil. We're a real metropolis on the banks of the Amazon River. There's 1.4 million people that live there. There's high rises, you know, or it's maybe defies your expectations of what the Amazon looks like. And the music defies your expectations of what it might sound like.
So we're talking about a place that is still, even in the early 21st century, kind of remote from the hubs of Rio and São Paulo.
Absolutely. It's São Paulo and Rio are rather far from the Amazon. You know, most people there will have never seen or traveled to those cities. And so musically, they have a lot of other stuff going on, stuff related to the Caribbean and stuff related to Latin America in general, which is something you don't see in Brazil very much.
So that kind of explains, in a way, the first piece we're going to hear, Mestre Vieira e Seu Conjunto. I mean, in Spanish-speaking countries, it would be conjunto, mm-hmm. but it's the same thing. It's an ensemble, right?
Yep.
And it's the kind of thing we associate with Cuban music or, you know, Caribbean music, and especially Spanish-speaking Caribbean music.
Yeah, so Mestre Vieira is one of these classic electric guitar players from the region, playing a style of music known as lambada, which comes from the word to whip. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that it's a fast-paced whipping music. The story of how all this Caribbean music became infused in the Amazon, they say that they were able to pick up radio signals from the Caribbean, and so they'd hear Dominican merengue and Cuban son and soca from Trinidad and all these different styles of music. The truth is, we're not really sure if radio really reached there, because radio, you know, it's quite far from the Caribbean, so we're not really sure if they really would have had the ability to pick it up except for on shortwave sets. But a lot of records,
which would have been out of the reach of most people.
Yes,
in
exactly.
That place
and
that
so
time.
A lot of records were coming in kind of from boats, contraband boats that would come in from the Guianas and other parts of the Caribbean. And they drop off these records, and local guys would listen to them and start imitating them. So you have this guy, Mestre Vieira, and he takes an electric guitar and starts playing these kind of repeating riffs that you hear in that kind of music. And people go crazy for it, and they play it on these, you know, local battery-powered sound systems.
What time period are we talking about here?
We're talking about the 70s and 80s. You know, that's when local versions of this stuff happens. You know, as earlier on in the 60s is when you're getting people just listening to these Caribbean records and freaking out about them.
Okay. So this is Mestre Vieira, Eseo Conjunto, and a song called Joia. Stuff from 1980, and the Brazilian artist known as Mestre Vieira e Seu Conjunto and his band, and a song called Joia, which is an example, as Marlon Bishop was just telling us, of kind of a roots or vintage lambada sound.
Mm-hmm.
That term lambada, there was that awful song like in the late 80s called Lambada. Did that have anything to do with what we're talking about?
It has very little to do with what we're talking about. What happened is the term Lambada became associated with this song. The hit version was recorded by a French band called Kauma. They had listened to a Brazilian artist who had done a version of this song, which was a cover of a Bolivian Andean song by a band called Los Charcas. And somehow the term lambada got attached to it, mm-hmm. and it became this massive hit. There was some dance flicks in the early 90s about lambada, the forbidden dance.
Yes,
and so the entire
right.
concept of lambada became kind of corrupted, or, you know, I don't want to say corrupted, but it
became something else.
It became something else yeah. in a lot of people's minds. So we all know the term lambada, but how many people would know that lambada is a style of hot guitar-led dance music from the Amazon? Very few, I'd
yeah. say. Most people will know it from this little bit of French pop music fluff. that is the international hit song from 1989 called Lambada by this French band Keoma. And yes, it's kind of fluffy, but it was very popular. And it seems like even in Brazil, Marlon, where the real Lambada music took place, that there was a period of time, maybe in the late 80s and 90s, where it kind of disappeared, or, you know, there was a rediscovery, as you write in your essay in the book.
Well, this happens kind of throughout Brazil, is you have the end of the dictatorship in the 80s and this, you know, influx of kind of optimism about the future and young people really getting into international sounds. And especially when we're talking about the middle class and upper middle classes, people really getting into international rock and pop and kind of leaving root sounds. And then in the 90s, you have these big revivals. And this happened in Rio with samba. This happened in Recife in the Northeast with a style of music called maracatu. And there's, you know, it happened in Bahia. It happened all over. And it did happen in the Amazon as well, though a little bit later on.
So we're speaking about the sounds of Amazonian pop music with Marlon Bishop, a staff producer for NPR's Latino USA and editor of the book Sounds and Colors Brazil, which is out now. And this kind of soundcheck guide to Amazonian pop, the idea of rediscovering the masters of guitar, was this a kind of Buena Vista social club moment for these older veteran musicians in northern Brazil?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. There was a musician named Pio Lobato who had a band called Cravo Carbono. And they were a band that mixed lambada with rock and pop and kind of tried to do something, that kind of fusion thing that was happening around Brazil. And he had the idea of bringing together all these old masters who had kind of fallen into obscurity. And it became this kind of surprise hit. People really dug it all over Brazil, especially in the Amazon where they had a cultural connection to it. But I think people from other parts of Brazil listened to it and thought, wow, this is something completely different. It sounds like other countries. It sounds like Latin America.
That's what struck me about most of the music that we're hearing here is the very strong Latin American influence.
Exactly.
Who is Felipe Cordero?
Felipe Cordero is the son of a pretty important lambada producer, and he's one of the leaders of this revival movement that's happening right now, where you have a whole bunch of artists who are coming out with new modernized takes on these old sounds and getting a lot of gigs around Brazil and getting a lot of attention for them.
This song is called Problema Seu from Felipe Cordero.
Você pra mim é problema seu. Você pra mim é problema seu. Você pra mim é problema seu.
Problema Seu is the name of the song from Felipe Cordero, part of this revival of traditional lambada music from the Amazon, from the northern state of Pará in Brazil. We're speaking with Marlon Bishop in the book Sounds and Colors, Brazil. He wrote the essay called Welcome to the Jungle, The Rise of the Amazonian Sound. And we're giving you a soundcheck guide to Amazonian pop as part of our run-up to the World Cup this summer in Brazil. How big a surprise was it for the rest of Brazil when all of this music started coming from this northern state that people, you know, was sort of out of sight, out of mind?
I think it was quite a bit of a surprise. You know, I think people had the sense that they had known everything about Brazilian music. There's so much of it, and Brazilians have a really high level of musical literacy about their country in general, I'd say. And you have certain regions that are kind of these canonized regional styles of music from Bahia, from Rio, from Pernambuco. And so all of a sudden this other stuff comes in and they're like, wow, this stuff is really cool.
So you mention a style in your essay a couple of times called Tecnobrega. What is Tecnobrega and how does that impact the current music that's coming out of the Amazon?
Well, the word brega means tacky or corny. Techno, We all know what techno means. Yeah. So it means kind of like techno cheese is the style of music.
So is it intentionally corny and cheesy?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, some people actually have decided to call this music electro melody and given it these other names because they don't like calling it that.
Yeah.
But yes, I think there's a camp to it. It's electronic music that comes from this sound system culture in Belém on these kind of poor outskirts. And people will bring these insane giant speaker setups with, you know, belching flames and LCD displays and all this stuff, and play this also Caribbean-inflected music, but very electronic, with these very over-the-top synthesizer lines, samples from cut-ups from all, like, realms of international pop culture, pitched-up vocals, you know, and it's just crazy dance culture, and it's a lot of fun.
And is Gabi Amarantos a part of that scene?
Gabi Amarantos is a star from the techno brega scene. She used to play in a band called Banda Techno Show. All the bands have Banda something before it. Mm-hmm. And she went on to become a really big star in Brazil recently. She put out a record in 2012 called Treme, and it took the raw material of techno brega and produced it with more production value. You know, this was stuff that was made on synthesizers and out-of-the-box software, and they did it with a studio and a band and kind of made it palatable to a broader market than the original stuff.
Let's hear a track from that 2012 record by Gabi Amarantos. This is called Shirley.
Eu vou samplear, eu vou te roubar. Eu vou samplear, eu vou te roubar. Eu vou samplear, eu vou te roubar. Vermelha, camisa preta, chegou pra abalar. Quando tu for na casa dela de buscar.
That is Gabi Amarantos from Brazil. Is she from Belém?
She's from Belém as well.
The city in the northern state of Pará in the Amazon. Song Shirley is from her 2012 record called Treme. Marlon Bishop with us here in the Soundcheck studio, our soundcheck guide to Amazonian pop. Part of our run-up to the World Cup in Brazil, Marlon is producing a radio documentary about music in the Amazon for our colleagues at Afropop Worldwide. Is there an indie movement? Are there indie rock bands who are sort of getting into this sound world now as well?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that's really happening is you have all these bands from other parts of Brazil who are saying, well, we want to take some of this and work with it. First, there are bands actually within Belém that would do this. Mm-hmm. There's this funny record your listeners might want to check out called Charque Side of the Moon, which is an entire Amazonian version of Dark Side of the Moon by a local band called La Pupunha. But then, there's a whole number of bands in Rio, from Goiânia, from other parts of the country who have been taking this material and doing stuff with it, both the techno brega and the roots stuff.
So you know, getting back to what I asked you before about whether folks in São Paulo and Rio sort of look down their nose up north at this remote state, now they're actually saying, wow, we need to get some of this.
Yeah, and I think people are interested in Amazonian music because it's a connection between Brazil and Latin America at large. Mm-hmm. You know, we see on the map Brazil is in the middle of South America, but they actually have had very little cultural conversation with the rest of the continent and what we normally think of as Latin music. And I think that right now there's more commercial connections between these places. Mm-hmm. There's more regional political connections and kind of development of solidarity, political solidarity between different governments. I think people are just kind of interested in checking out the neighborhood a little more.
Yeah. So this final piece we're going to hear from a band called Do Amor, they're from Rio, right?
Yes, this is a Rio-based band, and, you know, they heard some old recordings, and they're like, this is rad, we got to do something with it.
And, you know, as I listen to this song called Isso e Carimbo, to me it sounds like, you know, Congolese music from the 1960s, which is when Cuban music was a huge thing in African pop music. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of sound, So you were talking about that Caribbean, that Latin American influence still seems to be really obvious in this very recent music.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, those musical flows between Africa, the Caribbean, Brazil are so complex. And you see the Afro-Brazilian mix with the Caribbean sound, and it's not that surprising in a way.
The band is Do Amor. The song is Isso e Carimbo. Marlon Bishop is editor of the book called Sounds and Colors, Brazil, and has been giving us a sound check guide to Amazonian pop. Marlon, thanks very much.
It was wonderful to be here.
Tomorrow on the show, director and animator Ralph Bakshi famously earned the first X rating for an animated film. That was Fritz the Cat. Bakshi joins us to talk about that film, his history of American pop music, and the current retrospective of his work at BAM. Plus, violinist and looping whiz Owen Pallett began his career releasing records under the name Final Fantasy. Now he's a solo artist who often works with the band Arcade Fire. He'll join us to play live in the studio. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.